Good afternoon. Welcome to What Comes Next Live. We're about 10 minutes late because for some reason we had some tech gremlins. However, James Baer is coming to us live and direct with great audio and video from Geneva, Switzerland. James and I met over 3 years ago at the Modern Elder Academy, forming part of the Sweet Corazon cohort, and we have, as a group, been consistently meeting every week, almost without fail, for the last 3+ years, and got to know each other in lots of different ways, including even with the U.S. and largely California bent of our group. James has moved to Geneva, and he also formed a massive part of this by inviting our group to his wedding about 2 months after it, and it was with immense pleasure that I attended in California and then welcomed James and his husband to visit in London, which is really cool. James in Geneva is finding new ways to make a difference in the world in what he's doing, and his background is as a leader, innovative business development and health system initiatives, supporting improved care access, quality and value in global healthcare. I don't know much about his work, but I do know he's one of the most awesome humans. I'm just welcoming my friend on to talk about whatever, as with all my guests, talk about whatever comes to mind for him around what comes now, what comes next, what comes after what comes next. So welcome, James.
Thank you, Tom. I'm totally flattered that you asked me to join, and I've been listening to some of your previous podcasts and really enjoying the interactions and the conversations you've been having with others. I hope I can live up to such engaging dialogue as what I've heard from some of your other podcasts. They've been great.
Cool. So where would you like to begin?
Well, I thought a lot about this and thought what an interesting time it was that you and I met 3 years ago. It was a really important juncture in my own life, because as I think you recall, I had just lost my mother only a few months prior, and that was a big deal, as it is for any of us. She and I were particularly close, so there was a lot to go through there. And I decided to stop working, and was taking some significant time off. And I was getting ready to get married and getting ready to move to Geneva. So all those things were happening, and it was a big transitionary period. And I realized in the 3 years that you and I have known each other that for much of that time, and in the context of our ongoing connection with each other through the Sweet Corazon group, I've chosen to kind of lead with my heart and lead with my desire for meaningful, engaging relationships with all of you, and less with my professional self. And in the last year and a half now, my kind of renewed professional persona has just kind of surged, and I find myself deeply entrenched in my work again and excited about it. And listening to some of the other people who you've interviewed, I'm struck by a certain commonality of people getting to a point in life, and if they're lucky enough to slow down, regroup, and or have another perspective offered on themselves in the workplace, there's a blossoming that can happen. And I absolutely feel like that's what I'm experiencing right now. So yeah, in very, very specific ways. I mean, I'll do. I've heard a couple of your people do little mini bios, so I'll try to do that because only in the context that it's relevant to
Yeah,
where I am
absolutely.
today. So I was always determined to keep my life global. I had a grandfather who I'm named after, my mom's dad, who was in the U.S. Foreign Service. He was an agricultural specialist. And during all the years I was growing up, he and my grandmother were living in Turkey and in Jordan and throughout the Middle East, actually, for 25 plus years. So I aspired to a career and a life that kept me outside of the United States. And I kept on a pretty fast track around that. And I went into an undergraduate program. And mind you, this would be the late 70s. It was a program that had a second year abroad. No matter what you were doing within the school program overall, your second year was abroad. And that year brought me to China. And so I was 17 when I went to Beijing. It was 1979. It was the first year of the normalization of relations between the U.S. and China. So it was brand new days. There were 40 U.S. students in the entire country. There was no U.S. embassy. Everyone was still in Mao suits. We were restricted to a campus in the outskirts of Beijing that we had to have passes to come and go from. And I lived there for a year and I liked it well enough that I stayed a second year. And then I moved to Taiwan and spent two more years. And then I moved to Hong Kong and spent another 6 years studying Chinese, Mandarin throughout all of that time, and then becoming a tour guide in mainland China, primarily with British companies. And one U.S. firm. So representing the early days of, Western tourists being allowed into China. And so I kept everything really global and then eventually got back to California to finish my undergraduate degree and then to do a graduate degree in international policy studies and Chinese. I have a minor in Mandarin. And so I come out of that graduate program and now it's maybe 93 or something like that, early 90s. And I get hired by Stanford University Hospital. Massive. And for any of your listeners who don't know about U.S. medical centers, they are really massive research, education, and clinical machines. They're often trying to figure out which of those various three priorities matter most, and there's always a little bit of competition therein. But Stanford hired me to represent them in Asia. And so now, 35 years later, I've been in healthcare all this time, and I always say that I came into healthcare from the back door. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they wanted my Asia expertise. They wanted me to speak Mandarin. I had no idea what healthcare was all about. Right. So pretty early on, within the first year or so, I realized, it's about money. That what we were trying to do was to draw, very wealthy Asian patients to Stanford Medical Center for high-end care, for quaternary tertiary care. So we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 patients a year, but they were coming from very, very high-end procedures, and they were paying cash. They were not insured. There were no international insurance products. And Stanford at the time was netting, that is net bottom line, in the neighborhood of $2 million a year off of this program. Mm-hmm. Those were big bucks in those days to the hospital. And slowly but surely, I started to understand the economics of healthcare. And I went on, just to cut a long story short, and involve myself very much in the business side. What are the economics of care that is equally accessible? What are the unit costs of care that's provided for the primary level by a general practitioner versus that is provided by a specialist? What does it mean to be in hospital in terms of costs versus in an outpatient facility, et cetera? All the nuts and bolts. And that's really kind of where I planted my flag. And, you know, I realized in the context, the lofty context that is Stanford, and it's one of the top medical schools and one of the top, you know, research centers in the United States, that I was working with all of these people with high scientific knowledge and clinical expertise. And each one of them, I was working with chairs of the departments and with all of these sub specialists, and I was taking them to Asia with me, and I was learning about who they were, and here they all are bringing this expertise. Well, what am I bringing? Mm-hmm. I need to have something. And so I started to realize, it took a while, that I was bringing the business awareness and trying to marry the two, mm-hmm. trying to have it be clear that we could stay viable, that we could pay all the bills that needed to be paid, make sure that those with the specialist expertise were remunerated at a level they needed to be remunerated, while also forwarding clinical science and treating people well. And while I was building business in Asia, I was also coordinating a staff of international patient assistants. So these were people with, you know, bilingual or trilingual with various cultural backgrounds that could be an assistant to patients when they arrived. So I was very, very conscious of what it means to access care. And I don't think this is the time to do it, but I've had a lot of personal experiences around, you know, accessing care, taking family friends through my own care in multiple cultural contexts, and a son who I adopted from Guatemala at birth, who had some very big medical challenges back in 99, 2000. So all of these, you know, personal lessons combined with what I was watching on the professional front let me know on a human level just how critically important it was that care is provided in a way that a patient can understand, that family is incorporated as much as that patient wants family to be incorporated, and that it's accessible not just in terms of getting the services they need, but in understanding what their options are. And that's a myriad set of variables that need to be in place to make sure that happens. One of the tremendously important variables that must be addressed in order to assure fair access to care is the economics behind that care. And so this is all, you know, the benefit of I'm turning 60 this year, the benefit of of this many years doing this. Mm-hmm. And now it's all merging, in a really lovely way. So, let me pause there and see what that generates for you. But that's kind of, you know, that's my way of doing a very, very high level, bio about my professional trajectory. And then, you know, we can talk about what I've moved into today, if that suits.
Yeah. And I think it will, because I know a little bit about what you moved in today. I think if I keep it a little bit contextual, yeah, absolutely. When you and I met about 3 years ago, there is this word of liminality, of this sort of what our friend Chip Conley refers to as a gooey space. We both have a lot of transition going on personally, professionally, et cetera. As did a number of our cohort. And what has been really fantastic to observe in the last 3 years is how people have, you know, had the luxury in different ways to slow down, to assess that and move through it to what comes next, to that piece around being, I'd say our group varies from about 40 years old now as the youngest to somewhere in the late 60s as the oldest. But broadly, the average age would be now at this point, late 50s, early 60s. And, you know, we're just getting going. All right. I love that thing about going from leading yourself and if I may say others with heart. All right. And into that professional self and, you know, reclaiming that, and it's, you know, new surging and blossoming. So what you're actually doing now is very much that. And I guess there are two things come to mind to me, is like to talk a little bit about what you're doing now professionally. And then maybe also why you're chosen that now.
Sure, absolutely.
And then the piece that links to that for me is really, I'm always looking to see what can people take from these conversations, because fundamentally it's about, you know, my passion is around leadership but it's not complicated. It's simply being human. It's understanding people. I know you well enough to know that you've always had this leading with heart piece.
Yeah.
It was a particularly strong piece for a period of time when you.
That's fair.
So it's like now cresting 60 and about to surge into your 60s. Ride that wave. You know, you be able to share and teach so we can learn from you?
Sure. No, I'm in thinking a lot about this stuff these days. But first of all, I have to comment on your recollection of our focus, when we first met and throughout our time knowing each other, around liminality. The thing that really gets me, particularly with the pandemic, is how perpetual this darn state is. I thought this was a cute little chapter we were going to go through, and it turns out it's an entire lifestyle. So there is that. Boy, you know, this, the unknowingness has really defined a lot of the last few years for me. And as far as I'm projecting ahead, it's going to continue to define that. But yeah, so specifically what I'm doing right now is, working, in the area of sustainable finance and sustainable finance for health innovation in low and middle income countries. So, the roots of a, new way of bringing capital to bear on the development challenges facing the world, whether they be climate or poverty or gender equity or water or waste or many other really pithy, hairy, audacious problems that are facing the planet. Is a fascinating field, and it's a field that one of finance that has a lot of traction globally now, although I will credit Central Europe with and the UK included in driving kind of a leadership role, more on a vanguard of thinking about creative ways of rethinking the financing around these big global problems. And so that new thinking, a new alignment of funders, a new new stakeholders at the table around solving global health problems specifically is the field that I'm in and that has got great momentum at the moment. So very, very specifically, I'm now the managing director for a company called Baraka Impact Finance. And we are an online marketplace, mm-hmm. as well as an expert advisory service working with health innovators in Sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, and Latin America. We have a pipeline of over 200 companies at present. That number continues to grow. These companies are generally 2 to 5 years of operating experience. They've got funding behind them, generally grant funding, sometimes a little bit of equity or debt funding, and they're now raising between 1 and 5 million. Mm-hmm. So Baraka's pipeline sweet spot are those companies that are doing capital raises in the 1 to 5 million range. Mm-hmm. We have a number that, you know, go slightly higher than that, and we have a few that are lower than that. These companies are dominantly using AI, various forms of digital health, cloud-based solutions to leapfrog over calcified global health problems in local and regional markets. And they're fascinating groups of entrepreneurs. But most of those entrepreneurs are based in developing regions themselves, but we have a good handful that are here in Europe and a number in the United States also. We're developing solutions that can cost out and can scale in low and middle income countries. So the goal is now to get private capital to bear on these investment opportunities. So we have a network of 400 social mission driven investors. These are family offices, high net worth individuals and foundations who have already taken a portion of their portfolio and committed it to social mission driven causes. Mm-hmm. We are always looking to expand the portion of their investment resources that they're willing to put mm-hmm. towards these types of projects. We are focused on a combination of social impact plus financial return. Mm-hmm. All of our investments are targeted at market rate or above financial return. We believe there is a marrying of those two objectives that is absolutely achievable in the current environment, and super excited about that. Now, this isn't exclusive to Baraka, although Baraka globally is leading in terms of our focus on the health sector specifically. We are very actively building this marketplace, and the marketplace is probably important to say. Part of our approach is to bring in third-party credible data analytics to frame and contextualize the investment opportunities so that investors can quickly understand what the value add is. So specifically what that means I was on today with an entrepreneur in Kenya. She has been running her company Access Afia for about 12 years now. Access Afia serves primary care needs in the slums of Nairobi and other large Kenyan cities, specifically focused on peri-urban populations. She uses a combination of brick and mortar clinics and then a digital backbone so that they've got app-based access to care for a variety of services in addition to what they can provide on the ground. Mm-hmm. She is currently raising $2.5 million. Mm-hmm. Has, you know, an amazing track record and an amazing business plan. And I'm completely confident that she'll be successful in doing that. So, now how do we talk about Access Afia with, you know, contextualizing data? So we bring in World Bank and WHO and IHME data, which talks about the percentage of the Kenyan population living in peri-urban environments. Right. We look at mobile and internet penetration in order to contextualize why Access Afia's solution for mobile-based care makes sense in that context. Mm-hmm. We look at the physicians per thousand or midwives or nurses per thousand relative to what the WHO says it should be, in order to emphasize why this type of primary care solution is essential. So we're doing that with all of our 200 companies and with quite a complex data analytics module, the partnership here in Switzerland that we've set up and in Germany with Heidelberg University to help us curate this data and contextualize the investments. So, you know, for me, it's brilliant. I get to work with these entrepreneurs, and you know, you can hear my passion about it when I talk about Access Afia, but I can go on about any of these. I was on with two different Latin American companies yesterday, and they were absolutely amazing. So there's a grassroots personal connection that these entrepreneurs feel with their companies and their regions and their markets and their people that really speaks to me. And on the other hand, there's this macro perspective on how we're using capital and what private capital can be brought to do that is super exciting from a global paradigmatic kind of level.
So all of this, I've not heard you express it when I talked to you last about this, it was just when you were getting started. And I absolutely can hear the passion and it was very important that you mentioned your bio because you do bring all that business awareness and experience, and the word accessible is one you use a lot, right? So you sit in the middleman space between finance and the entrepreneur, and just, you know, it's all about accessibility, which is really cool. What I'll throw in there is that some of the core articles I've written in the last 4 years of the sort of 1,350 plus daily pieces are at the bottom of my website. So if anybody listening to this wants to go to tommccallum.com, there's a piece called Leading with Purpose. And in that, I took the triple bottom line of profit, people, and planet that had really guided the UN's SDGs and other such things. And with a focus on ESG and other such areas, two or three years ago, I kind of thought this needs evolved. So I've got a nice green virtuous circle spinning flywheel diagram where it starts with purpose, then people and planet.
Yeah.
What it doesn't do is ignore the word profit. And an awful lot of I love business, and I love business as a force for good, which is kind of the tagline of B Corps, for example. But the word sustainable finance, it's only sustainable at some level if the people putting the finance in there get a return. And that's quite hard language.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable simply having people who've made billions when they're not flying off into space with their money, right?
Apparently
it's happening. Just deciding that they will, you know, have this model of I'll make billions first, and then when I feel like it, I'll give it to people.
Right.
If we can catch people earlier, at the moment we'll be working with foundations and funded by billionaires often and family offices, multi-generational. But sustainable finance has to have profit. But for me, it becomes the difference between what's the driver. In the triple bottom line, it's still the driver was still the first word. Profit. oh, and let's do something for the people and the planet, which when that was designed in 94, I think it came out, was very powerful. And it did act as a nice, concise driver of things like the United Nations and the different global NGOs.
Sure.
However, looking at it my way, that evolution, I call it a scale for impact model, right? Because it's purpose as the driver, right? Then people and planet. And at the bottom of the flywheel, which feeds it, is you have to keep your eye on the profit. There has to be a return. And when you have that, you know, I mean, classic example everybody uses in this space is Patagonia. And the last CEO stepped down, Rose Macario, said, the more good we do, the more money we make, which is the simplest way to put it. They are a environmental movement masquerading as a for-profit corporation because they do the first and the second supports the first.
Well, I mean, this is being proven, you know, throughout the markets globally with companies that have chosen to keep prominent ESG, environmental, social, and governance criteria in their business management. And those, you know, ESG screened companies and stocks and mutual funds and ETFs that are made up of ESG screened or companies are outperforming. And I know this on a very personal level. During mid pandemic, or I guess it was a year ago pandemic. I think we're still in mid pandemic. That's a separate conversation, but a year ago, during that portion of the pandemic, I had some time on my hands like we all did. And so I reallocated all my retirement funds. And that makes it sound like there's a lot, not really that much, but there was money to take and responsible kind of approach to take with it. And I put them into a series of ETFs and mutual funds, about a dozen of each of those categories of vehicles. And they have outperformed the S&P several fold in the last 12 months. Now, I don't think ESG is the end all and be all. That's another conversation. That's an entire,
It's in the right direction.
In the right direction.
I will tell you something else that I know, because I do talk to and work with people all over the place in different fields.
Yeah.
We know that private equity is a huge driver, right now. And it's not sustainable finance in my mind, because in its current form, because it takes things out of the public realm, so it's not accessible unless you're high net worth. But also the typical model is buy it, drive cost efficiencies, move it on within 5 years.
Right.
So there's nothing sustainable about that approach.
No.
And what's an interesting confluence is that in the private markets where businesses are available to either take private or privately held businesses to be bought by private equity. Right? And there's a lot of consolidation going on, driven by this finance in virtually every sector in the world. The valuations of the ESG strong companies are higher. So it's a very interesting confluence that if you're looking at somebody, go, oh, they tick the ESG boxes, they're getting more money. Now, at the moment, to some extent, it's a market sentiment. It's a bit of a box ticking exercise. But on the other hand, it's moving everything in the right direction.
Absolutely.
It does need to be backed up. So what you're talking about, and it's, I do thank you for using a live example of the business you're involved, that you're deeply involved with as a managing director. Because I do hear the naysayers still saying, oh yeah, it's all just talk. It's all just box ticking. And CEOs ultimately only care about making money in their stock options. Well, there are a whole bunch of those people out there.
Right.
If anybody wants to get a real sense for answering the question, do you have to be fair to win? A guy called David Badanis wrote my favorite book of the last year called The Art of Fairness. And it's a fantastic, it's a fantastic book. And the honest, the TLDR, too long didn't read for those who don't have young friends, on that is you can, for a certain period of time, but it'll catch up with you in the end. Which brings us right back to leading with heart.
Yeah, it does. And you know, and it's funny, that it's a good segue, because I did want to mention a book that's been quite inspirational to me in just the last couple of weeks, by, I'm blanking on his first name, but it's Seneca Jenkel. and it's Now Make the Change. Mm-hmm. He has a neurosciences and Silicon Valley startup and psychiatric services background, a real, you know, conglomeration of different fields. But he speaks about stuff that I know will resonate with you, Tom, that really has been resonating with me about leadership. And I don't think I can really do it justice, but first of all, he describes the context in which we are all living and working, and he uses an acronym that is taken from the U.S. military called VUCA, V-U-C-A. So it's mm-hmm. Volatile, unstable, chaotic, and
ambiguous,
right? So he keeps on talking about the VUCA environment that we're all in, and then he talks about modalities of working in that environment and what the options are to us. And he talks about two dominant modalities. One is to control and protect, CNP, and the other one is to create and connect. So control and protect is what we do when we're, you know, throw out the Excel spreadsheet when we've got a new problem in front of us and we want to one way or another get this into something that we can all understand together, or that at least you as the leader can understand and have a sense of control. And the create and connect is when, you know, all the neurons are open and you are allowing a more, you know, free flow of ideas mm-hmm. and of inputs and less of a prescriptive approach to how things move forward. Again, I don't think I can do justice, but I love the way that he writes about these two different modalities, and it's really informed. So right now I have a team of 12. We're spread out between Bogota, Lagos, Mumbai, Kuwait, here in Central Europe and in the US. It's a dynamic, interesting group of people. And I care so much about keeping a culture going that really keeps the enthusiasm alive for this unique thing that Baraka is taking on. And I so value the individual skills that each of these people bring in. And I've led for a lot of my life, but it's really helpful to me at this juncture to remind myself on a daily basis to stay in the create and connect modality. And nothing serves a startup business better than that energy, and nothing serves the team building better.
Yeah, the really concise version is leading from heart. And the VUCA came from, for the listeners, it came from the United States War College about a few decades ago, with global military leaders realizing that, you know, the old way didn't work. And it was volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And a number of years ago, an interesting management thinker or leadership thinker called Bill George came up with what he calls VUCA 2, which is nice and concise, and I love it. But fundamentally, it's that shift from command and control, and there's a thing called the OODA loop. You might be familiar with that too.
No, I don't know the OODA loop. Tell me.
It's how fighter pilots operate. Observe, orient, decide, and act. And they can do it many, many times. And part of this is that the command and control, this idea of command and control leadership, you know, that in the military, with the right energy and focus and culture, makes absolute sense. You need to give the framing, you need to give boundaries, right? But if it's not toxic, fear-based leadership, it doesn't work. So the idea of VUCA 2 is simply, in my language, and I put this at a sort of highly contextual level, is a flip of how to deal with uncertainty and volatility in a love space rather than a fear space, right? In that type of energy.
Right.
So the VUCA 2 is vision, understanding, courage, and adaptability.
Oh, lovely. That's great.
It's slightly different. So, and I think that I think we are in that space. It's really exciting. And I think we're both in a place of being excited and energized by it. There is a different kind of leadership that can come forward, and it will create sustainable finance, and it will create market returns, and it will make capital accessible to those healthcare provision and accessibility entrepreneurs around the world. And will allow those people who are ahead of the game a little bit on their, where they want to allocate their finance to gain access.
Yeah. Yeah.
and to bridge it into those metrics and data and stuff. So it's very cool, and I'm very and I would imagine there's just listening to your example is going to be valuable and inspirational for a lot of people. Sometimes we need reinforcement. It's like that everything works, and I love the accidental strategic plan you have behind you. Inhale, exhale, repeat. And I'll show you this one that I have stuck up here on my wall because it's not visible otherwise. And this is from a past guest on my show called Steve Chapman. Can you see it?
I actually can't read it. Bring it a little closer.
It's a 10-year plan.
Oh, that's great.
Do stuff. See what happens. And then an if-then loop. Am I dead? All right. Tombstone.
That's great. That's
nope.
Great.
Do more stuff. See what happens. So we've got plans behind us.
That's the spirit. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, when you're up against kind of entrenched worldviews and styles and belief systems, and I'm specifically speaking about private equity. And capital returns and what the world believes is necessary to keep that cycle going. You need a lot of reinforcements to suggest that there might be an alternate paradigm in which this can be done and social impact can be achieved. So
I love the blend that you're doing with leading from heart, but also making it real, giving them the numbers and all this stuff. It's really cool. So we've run over a little bit, and we could talk for hours, I'm sure. Let me do what I always like to do, is just leave my guests with the last word.
Well, let me tell you that you called out the posters behind me here, which actually, when my husband and I moved into this rented flat, were already hanging on this wall. I didn't put them there. And what they say is inhale, exhale, repeat. There is no more important reminder to all of us. Do it consciously. Do it regularly. Life goes better. More things open up when you keep that rhythm going. So I'll leave it at that.
Perfect. Thank you so much, James. It's been a pleasure and a privilege.
Totally. Likewise.